So also, it's a quick and dirty paper. Lee and I got tired of writing these magnum opus things. This is actually just, in some sense, a quick add-on to the gravitational waves paper that we did a couple of years ago. A few things have changed as far as the detectability of R-modes in young neutron stars. And we wanted to get a feel for how the changes were affecting things. Partly we wanted to know for LIGO reasons. LIGO is putting in the enhanced interferometer R&D proposal pretty soon. We wanted to see, well, the main determining force there is going to be how well they do detecting neutron star binary end spirals, but we wanted to see what it looked like for R-modes as well. So this we're asking, I should say, if you really want to look at the issue of detectability, it can get very complicated. If you've been awake for the last couple of weeks, then you've heard all of these different things people have been talking about. There's a huge amount of unknown, interesting neutron star physics going on that ties into the R-modes. There are lots of uncertainties in saturation amplitudes. We were thinking like 10 to the minus 2 sometimes, or then people have been putting up saturation amplitudes of order 10. We don't know if this thing makes a soliton and spins down in some funny way, or how magnetic fields affect it, all sorts of things. The nice thing is, if we ask a very specific question now, what is the optimal signal-to-noise, which is a fundamental limit on how well you can do set-by-signal processing, assuming that a lot of the practical problems along the way get solved, the optimal signal-to-noise you can get at a distance of, say, 20 megaparsecs, where the Virgo cluster is, and we expect a lot of supernovae to go off, like one a week or so, this fundamental limit only depends on all of this interesting complicated physics in the form of a couple of parameters, and it's pretty easy to explore those. So we do that as we do a bit of parameter space exploration on the signal as well as on the noise, using the new LIGO noise curves.
Will you explain what you mean by optimal signal to noise? Because I would say, I would guess optimal is infinity.
No, so you can prove, there's an old theorem by Wiener that you can prove that for any linear signal processing method, and I think it actually works for nonlinear signal processing methods as well, there's a certain maximum you can do. If you've got a signal of some amplitude buried in noise of some RMS amplitude, essentially the best way to look for it, if you know exactly what you're looking for, is something called mesh filtering, or sometimes Wiener filtering, because he was the one who came up with it. You basically take a template, you add some functional form of the signal you're looking for, and you integrate that against what comes out of your detector, which is signal plus noise. And that does very well at picking out signal and pitching the noise. You can prove that that's the best you can do. Simply, you make a vector space of the possible signal and noise functions. And it's just a matter of maximizing the dot product between two vectors. And so if you take some arbitrary filter, you have two vectors, the way you maximize them is you make them parallel. And if you take some arbitrary filter, the way you maximize it is by making it exactly the signal that you're looking for. Now, in the case of the R-modes, exactly means you would have to, in order to really do mesh filtering, you would have to track the signal over, say, 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 cycles. There's no way we're going to know things that well anytime in the next few decades. But there, without going into a lot of the messy details of data analysis, there are ways that you can get fairly close to optimal signal to noise. Anyway, we just picked optimal signal to noise because, well, number one, it's easy. It's a lot easier than dealing with the real data analysis problem. And number two, it does set a fundamental upper limit to what we can do. So it's like when the LIGO people talk about their noise designs, their engineering limitations and science limitations. Like you can't beat the quantum limit. Well, you can a little bit. But things like, you know, the servo is causing problems, well, those can be dealt with enough know-how. And here I'm assuming that somehow we'll figure out how to deal with the data analysis problems and get within spitting distance of this fundamental limit. All right, so discussion around here in this crowd would probably be the most lively when I talk about the signal. So I'll start with the noise. The noise curves we've been plugging in are are hot off the press. These are LIGO 2 noise curves. As of last week, there's a benchmarking software written mainly by Sam Finn that you can pick up that generates these noise curves. You can get it pretty easily. The LIGO website, you navigate through down to the LIGO 2 reference design, and there are a lot of numbers there that describe the physics that's going on here. And there's a link to the bench website, Sam Finn page. The noise curves have changed a fair bit since 1998 when this gravitational waves paper came out. There are all sorts of miscellaneous improvements. I want to get this over with, so I won't talk much about them, except to say one thing that's changed fairly recently, even since the white paper last year, which a lot of you got when Pip sent this email out, there's a big new noise source called thermoelastic noise, which something people did neglected before, and it turned out that it almost negated a lot of the gains that people got since 1998. But the good news is that, the bad news is that it really becomes the dominant noise source in the region of best sensitivity, frequencies of 100, 200 hertz or so. The good news is all the other people in LIGO are adapting their subsystems to minimize the effect of this. Various things like making the beam spot bigger, so you don't have to worry about it as much. It turns out the noise curves are going to change again this week to adapt for fallout from the LSC meeting last week. Or I guess it's 2 weeks ago now. They're going to put in a model for the suspensions, which doesn't really concern the R mode people because that happens down at a few tens of hertz. They're also, one thing that might concern us a bit is they're going to put in correlations between radiation pressure and shot noise. This affects how the interferometer behaves when you narrow band. Now, like LIGO is mainly a broadband instrument, is this high enough for everybody to see now? Okay, LIGO is mainly a broadband instrument, but you can tune mirror parameters in the signal recycling mirror mainly to narrowband. The main way that they're going to do this is searching, optimizing the mirror parameters so that you get the best possible signal to noise for neutron star binaries. That's LIGO's bread and butter source, but we thought it'd be nice to see what they could get for R modes, as long as they're looking for neutron star binaries. It's not clear, but by changing mirror transmissivities and the locations of the mirrors, it's not clear whether they'll be able to do that online or if they'll just put a couple of, maybe two or three mirrors in different locations and have the ability to switch between them. That's something they're debating right now. But at any rate, it's certain that they're going to tune these things for neutron stars, and they may, even in the worst case where they can't tune it for manpower reasons or duty cycle reasons or whatever, they will have some sort of narrowband configuration operating on some cavity, say narrowbanding at 600 hertz with say 100 hertz width on either side. This is something that they would do to look for say crust bumps from low mass X-ray binaries. So I fooled around with parameters. There's no official version of that narrowband noise curve yet, but I fooled around and came up with one that is fairly arbitrary but not too unreasonable. Results look like this. Let's get that a little higher up too. This graph, okay, the main line on this graph you should be concerned with is this blue one. This is the noise curve for sapphire test masses, which they think they can do, but they're not sure. And with the mirror tuned for optimal signal noise for neutron star binaries. The vertical axis here is RMS strain noise in the detector. For noise aficionados, it's the square root of the frequency times the power spectral density of the noise. This is the sapphire test mass configuration. This is if they can only use fused silica in the end, which is the LIGO 1 design. And this green curve here is the narrowband noise curve that I picked at random. You can see it goes down to a minimum around 600 hertz. Basically, when you're tuning the mirrors, you're fighting radiation pressure noise in the low frequency end and shot noise in the high frequency end. And if you tune this too far over here, you run into thermal noise, including that nasty thermoelastic noise in this region.
Well, what is the
thermoelastic noise? The physical origin is basically...
Is it thermoelastic noise or is it...
So it's, there are all kinds of noise sources within the test mass. But the physical origin of this, in one sentence, is it's time fluctuating ripples in the surface of the test mass due to fluctuations in the heat transport within the test mass. Overall, it's in thermal equilibrium, more or less, but you get little packets of heat moving here and there on a finite time scale. And as if this region gets a little bit hotter, then it expands a little bit. You get a little bump, and that messes up the phase front of the light, and that messes up your signal a little bit. So this is why, for example, everybody else had to retune the optics to make the beam spot a lot bigger so that they could average over a lot more ripples, get less noise. All right, so these three curves are various possible noise curves for LIGO 2. The beauty of this kind of a plot is if you had some sort of signal, like this red line here, traces along, cuts off at some frequency, we don't know what. I'll talk more about this putative R-mode signal momentarily. The beauty of this kind of plot is you get the signal to noise almost by reading it off. So actually, if you want the square of the signal to noise, you integrate the signal line squared over the noise lines squared per logarithmic interval of frequency. And the frequency is log scale, so you can just read things off. And I'll say what the signal to noise is and what the signal is more in a minute. Well, okay, so before I put the signal and noise together, let's talk about where the signal comes from. As I said before, all of this interesting, wonderful, complicated physics, in the end, assuming that you get everything else optimized for it, boils down to a couple of parameters due to an argument by Roger Blanford, which is often cited but was never published. Blanford's argument is very nice. It says that assuming that gravitational radiation is the dominant torque on the neutron star, so you can forget about magnetic braking, which is probably pretty reasonable, at least for most of the spin down. All you need are three parameters. You got to know the starting frequency of the signal, the stopping frequency of the signal, the lower limit on it, and the moment of inertia of the neutron star. Well, you also need to know the relation between gravitational wave frequency and the star's rotational frequency, but that's not such a problem. Now, there's a lot of people who've probably never seen this before, and it's a pretty sweet argument, so let me go through it briefly. I'll commit the sin of writing down some equations, but it's only a few lines. The way this works is you're interested, say, so in some H, the signal that I was plotting is related to H tilde, which is the Fourier transform of H, your gravitational wave strain that you catch in the detector. And what we want to look at is not for the best possible source we can get, but for some average source at 20 megaparsecs. So you need to average over the angles that the source could have, say the inclination of the neutron star's rotation axis to the line of sight of the Earth, and you also want to average over the detector sky. So where this neutron star is with respect to LIGO, and there's also a polarization angle that comes in there. So if you take that quantity squared, you average it over all the angles involved. You can work this out. It's a fifth times the average just over the angle of the source, the angles of the rotation axis of the line of sight. If you use the stationary phase approximation, which works really well for the R-modes, they're a very sinusoidal signal. You can relate the Fourier transform of the H plus and the H cross simply to the time domain H plus and H cross amplitudes. And then you play with Leibniz's rule, you write that out as DJDF and DJDT. Now the stellar structure of the neutron star tells you that unless you get some funny sort of soliton behavior, that DJDF is pretty simple. It's basically the moment of inertia plus some order 10%, at most 10% corrections, depending on how the moment of inertia goes up with frequency and depending on how the gravitational wave frequency is related to the star's spin frequency. But basically, it's this constant. gravitational radiation theory tells you dj dt, the total angular momentum coming out, you just integrate over a sphere, your distance d to the source, you plug in all these factors, you're looking at a couple of time derivatives of the strain, there's an omega squared and so on, you integrate over this big sphere around the source, and it's proportional to this quantity, this average of h squared. And when you plug those back into the formula for what you actually observe, this factor cancels this factor, and the end result is that your observed quantity in the frequency domain, averaged over all the angles you want, it has a very simple dependence. It only matters this actually goes as the signal to noise squared. So the signal to noise goes as the square root of the moment of inertia for the neutron star, and it goes as 1 over the distance to the source. So once you've got that, all you need to know is where does it start and stop in the frequency band. All right, so going back to this, what we take is the signal. Let's say that we do get some fraction of these 50 supernovae or so a year out of 20 megaparsecs. Let's say we do get some fraction of them born, the neutron stars, well, number one, they make neutron stars, and number two, the neutron stars are spinning very fast. So let's take starting gravitational wave frequency, a kilohertz or something big like that. It doesn't matter so much because it all gets drowned in like it's shot noise at high frequency anyway. That's also nice because the various 10% corrections or so I was talking about also get drowned in the shot noise, and you can work with low frequency quantities that are better known. Let's take from Cook, Shapiro, and Tucholsky this standard sort of catalog of relativistic neutron star models. Let's take the smallest moment of inertia, so the softest equation of state they believe in, which is 10 to the 45 CGS units. This could go up by a factor of 2.2 or so. You can take the square root of that. That means the signal to noise could go up by a factor of 1.5, which is good. All these other, I didn't write this out, but all these other corrections that you look at, it turns out, also would bring the signal to noise up by a little bit. So if we take these fiducial numbers, we're actually putting a fairly good lower bound on the signal to noise we can expect. And so then all we need to know is what's this final frequency that the thing spins down to? Gravitational wave frequency. And we don't know that at all. I mean, that's just crazy. I mean, the crust, the whole crust business had the final spin down frequency going up by a factor of, up and down by a factor of 5 every couple of months. And then there's all these nonlinear, what does saturation do to it? And, you know, do you get magnetic field wind up and all that? So let's just leave this parameter completely unknown and graph it. Well, let's put some bounds on it. We do have this one data point, this fast young pulsar in the Large Magellanic Cloud. This thing is running, its spin period now is 16 milliseconds. It's about 5,000 years old. You basically run through the machinery that Vicky Caspi talked about a couple of weeks ago, and you put the most optimistic error bars you can on all the numbers. Then the lowest this thing possibly could have gotten the gravitational wave frequency was 100 hertz or so.
Yeah.
Right. If you look at the frequencies we're actually interested in, the corrections, they're more like 1.5% or something. It's really, considering all of the huge number of other things we don't know about neutron stars, I mean, the moment of inertia period is not known to a factor of 2. This is pretty small potatoes.
Why is it sensitive to high frequency? Why is the signal always sensitive?
Because the shot noise.
The shot noise goes up.
The signal
is vanishing into the noise up here anyway. Unless you tune your interferometer to 2 kilohertz or something. You can, but we're assuming that LIGO's not going to do that. We're assuming, see, the R modes are a sideshow for LIGO. Mainly they're worried about neutron star binaries, where they're going to be tuning down here. And maybe if they can, they're going to be looking for low mass X-ray binaries, which, you know, they're going to be pretty conservative, I think, and they're going to say, well, this R mode show. Who knows if this is still going to be around in a couple of years, but there are a lot of things that'll make make gravitational waves at twice the spin frequency. And we know there's a lot of things at 300 hertz spin frequency, so let's look around 600 hertz. And if we do happen to catch R modes while they're going through that band, then that's lanyap. That's good, that's extra.
So you're going to be searching, say, over the range of moment of inertia when you search for the
signal? No, you don't need, the moment of inertia just determines how much you get. It's the signal
noise.
It's
general distance.
Yeah.
Percent sounds like a lot. It's true, you're actually trying to make this template. It's going to predict all 10-9 cycles.
All right.
But in this optimal signal noise estimate, you only change that by the square root of 10%. So the estimate of what is the very best you can do is pretty insensitive to it. But actually accomplishing that tensorial amount is
right. DFDT dropped out of those equations in Blanford's argument, but DFDT matters a lot if you're trying to actually do the data analysis.
This is talking about the best you can do, not
how to actually do it. Yeah, remember, this is just the fundamental limits. Actually getting there is a different story.
So you are assuming you know the evolution of those 10 limits?
Fairly well.
We have to
know
the whole 10
limits. Yeah.
Right.
And then these limits are just like the amplitude.
Right, so you can get within, and even if you have a pretty vague knowledge of the signal, you can get within a factor of two or so.
So are you sensitive though to this intersection point where the noise curve intersects with the, yeah, that one?
No, because the total signal to noise that you get is by integrating up the difference between these two curves. So most of your signal to noise is coming from around here. This little bit up here, you're just not getting much
contribution.
So at high frequencies, you are getting a lot more energy coming out, but it's sweeping through frequencies faster, so you're not integrating as long. And the shot noise is just killing you up there anyway, so you just don't get anything.
If the noise curve was flat, you would get most of the signal
at
high frequencies. So I wonder whether it would be a good question to ask how sensitive the signal to noise is not to signal parameters, not to the noise parameters.
There's a graph coming up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. How much does nonlinearity of the R modes change all this?
This bit? All that matters is the final frequency. Tell me how far it spins down. Nonlinearity doesn't matter. That's what Blanford's argument is about.
No, but you need to know a single mode, single frequency.
Yeah, so
the evolution of a single mode, and you've got a whole bunch of modes in this stuff. This nonlinear thing, it's a mess, right?
No,
the mess is mode
organized
into that kind of frequency.
Well, presumably, since you basically captured all the energy that was released up to this final frequency, and not so much.
Yeah, it does basically assume that all of the gravitational wave energy is from the
frequency.
That's
right. That's
not really. It assumes that you know, however that it's coming out, you know.
It's not
actually assuming that. It's just assuming that you know how it's coming out. If it's coming out at different frequencies, then maybe, you know, you build your data analysis method to take advantage of that. This is just the upper limit. It assumes how you know things are coming out, and everything sorts itself out of that. Then all that matters is that gravitational radiation breaking is dominant.
No, I think the argument actually assumes that there's only one frequency at a time.
No, because what comes in there is d omega df, and if you have different frequencies coming out, you just have a sum of the terms like that. This does assume that you know how it's coming out, but it doesn't just necessarily assume that it's all coming out at one frequency. In practice, it'll get a lot harder to catch it if it's getting smeared out all over the place, but you can still catch it.
I'm not absolutely sure that this argument actually even works if it's a sonic
spin. It does. It does. You just need to put in a d omega df term.
Okay.
Yeah.
However, one more comment. Yeah. It seems to me that all of this nonlinear stuff is going to be worse at the high frequency end.
Maybe.
When things are rapidly
Maybe.
Rotating.
At least they're nonlinear all the way down.
Yeah.
Right, so I should say, actually, this is one thing that occurred to me while I was writing this, is that if, okay, so if you do have some funny frequency business going on, okay, there's angular momentum is I omega, and so I've just dropped out the omega. But in reality, you've got a dj by d omega and then a d omega by df. And if d omega by df is funny, so if you've got this soliton, for example, if it makes some soliton and it does like the Maclaurin spheroids going to Dedekind and ellipsoids, so that all f goes down a lot while omega's not going down much, then that will suppress it. But I think that's a different question. Okay, anyway, where was I? Right, so we have this final frequency that things spin down to is an unknown parameter, and taking conservative values for the other parameters, what does it look like? Well, it looks pretty good. In spite of the setbacks, it looks better than it did a couple years ago. So this is optimal signal-to-noise ratio as at 20 megaparsecs, angle averaged, all that stuff, as a function of the final spin down frequency. The blue curve, again, is the standard LIGO sapphire test masses optimized for neutron star binaries. This tells you if you have a signal that starts off way up here at some high frequency, you know, it goes down, you're not getting much signal to noise. This is the cumulative signal to noise, by the way. If it spins down a long way, all the way down to 100 hertz or so, you get a signal to noise ratio of like 13 or so. Optimal signal noise of 13. So if you lose a factor of 2, which it seems reasonable, if we do get a handle on how the frequency evolves and we can do data analysis, then you can actually detect these things at 20 megaparsecs, which would be great.
So you think about it too, it must be very
how
well we
know. No, so what Brady and Creighton did was people have looked at this situation where you just expand the frequency in a power series of like some god-awful huge power series of like 30 coefficients. You don't know what any of them are. You don't even make an assumption as to whether the star is spinning up or down. Just completely blind search, you can get within a factor of 10. And so if you put in any physics at all, for example, say you know the thing's going to spin down, that cuts your parameter space in half, and then and various other things you can do. Just my intuition, my gut feeling from looking at the way people have built robust signal-to-noise methods for short-duration bursts is that, you know, getting a factor of 2 or 3 is optimistic, but not that unreasonable. I mean, a factor of 3 is halfway there already from completely blind. So that's pretty good. That says we can get a signal-to-noise ratio of 3 with the, I mean, we can get a signal-to-noise ratio, optimal signal-to-noise, well in excess of 10 or so, if the R mode makes it down a long way, just if we're looking for it while LIGO is tuned for neutron star binaries. If LIGO does operate another cavity at the same time centered on 600 hertz, then you also get this green line. And that cavity is going to pick up, well, it's basically a smoothed out step function around 600 hertz, as you might guess. And that's really interesting, because that says even if, say, the R mode never gets big enough in the beginning to melt the crust, and you get turbulent saturation, and you get this melting frequency of 500 hertz or so, well, this whole range, whether it stops at 100 or 500, taking the maximum of these curves, you're still covered pretty well. Optimal signal noise is better than 10. So one or the other configuration is going to pick things up. That's nice to know. That gives us the impression that the R modes, because of their broadband nature, assuming we get the data analysis tricks worked out, the R mode detectability is very robust to how they start tweaking the interferometer. That's good.
So something asks what you mean by 10. Let's say you're going to do a search for Bergen, so you know where to bury center your data within some angle.
Okay.
So 10 means how many searches do you get to do before you get hit?
You mean before your false alarm rate gets ridiculous?
Right.
People have talked generally with a single interferometer. People usually look at a threshold of order 8 or so, and that's one false alarm for a few years, something like that. If you put 2 interferometers, then it goes down by square root of 2. So you could actually put a threshold of like 5.5 or 6. So, let's see, one thing I didn't mention is that things don't look as good. I mean, if they cannot get Sapphire working, then this yellow curve is the fused silicate test masses optimized for neutron star binaries, and that's pretty bad, because the thermoelastic noise and all that stuff gets you. Well, relatively bad, I should say. This is still a little better than what we were looking at in 1998. There we were looking at 7-point-something for stopping at 120 hertz.
Sapphire known to be better for thermal noise?
Well, as far as a lot of things go, Sapphire is known to be better. The thing is, fused silica is something they know they can do. They're doing it right now for LIGO 1. Sapphire is something that would require a new technology, but it's new technology that's probably can be developed within the next couple of years. So Sapphire is actually the main thing they're shooting for right now, and silica is a fallback design.
I recall that some crucial properties of Sapphire have not been measured. Is that right?
The thermoelastic noise for Sapphire is worse than for fused silica, but fused silica has such high thermal noise, which is not related to thermoelastic effects. So possibly Sapphire is better.
But it just depends on this one guy who makes it.
The big problem is how to coat the sapphire.
The problem is even how to make a single crystal large enough.
Yeah, 30 kilogram sapphires don't grow on trees.
Right.
Go down to the local jewelry store and pick one up.
You know. How to coat it.
Yeah. All right, so... Anyway, I'm just about done then. So the upshot of this is it looks like the R-modes, if LIGO does operate one cavity broadband and one narrow band, it looks really good. You'll pick the R-modes up, even if they only make it down to 500 hertz or so, the good signal-to-noise ratio, assuming all the data analysis problems get solved. So the rough idea you get from this is that the R-modes are pretty robust to whatever tweaking LIGO is going to do with its design parameters. And that's good, because they sure aren't going to tweak their design parameters at our say-so. They're going to look at neutron stars. Just a couple of quick graphs. This is the one Yuri was looking for, right, actually. If you play with a couple of interferometer parameters, the X and Y axes are some parameters. Don't worry about what they are. It's getting close to lunchtime. But basically, if you go down on here, you're narrowbanding. If you go up on here, you're broadbanding. And if you tune the other parameter to the left, you've got a low pass band, and to the right, you've got a high pass band. And in this, looking at some range of parameters, so this is neutron star detectability. As a signal to noise ratio of 8, you can get out to 200 megaparsecs or so. The blue cross is where they're thinking of operating it. This maximum up here is very flat, so that they could move it all around depending on what happens. The narrowband noise curve that I picked out is down here. So this region of parameters gives you an idea of where they're going to tune based on their main source, the neutron stars, the binary neutron stars. And if you make a similar graph for the R modes,
what are these numbers? So,
these numbers are ranges at signal to noise of 8. So 200 megaparsecs is the range they want to get right now. And they could get that by tuning all over in this region and lose 5% by going out to here. So this is sort of the area they're going to be looking at, even if other parameters get tweaked a little bit.
What are the numbers of the axes?
Okay, so you actually care what these are. All right, so this is the signal recycling mirror transmittance. As you go up, you're getting broadband, because of course you take the mirror away and you've just got power recycling. So this is the, if you lump the other Fabry Perot cavities together and treat them as one mirror, this is the effective transmittance of that mirror. And there's also actually the tuning phase of the signal recycling mirror. I didn't put that in. That doesn't change things by much. Right. And the numbers just don't get changed very much. So if you do this sort of thing for R modes, looking at the same region where they'll probably be operating for neutron star binaries, it looks great. And the R modes have even bigger contours. The R modes are incredibly robust. They're even more robust when you start narrowbanding. This is, well, assuming you get down to 120 hertz, this is what the optimal signal noise looks like. It's a 13 or so on the operating point for neutron star binaries, and it's 11 point something if you're down here on this narrow band. And if you play with the narrow banding a bit, it stays around 10 to 12 or so. It's very robust. Our mode detectability can survive all sorts of tweaks they're going to do, which is good. That's it. No questions? Don?
There's been some talk of, I guess I've heard a claim that for any source that you can detect locally, so binary inspirals or hard modes, you should be able to detect it with cosmologically with comparable signals to noise.
As a stochastic background, you mean?
Yeah.
Using a template? I don't understand. You mean match filtering for things that are 10 times as far away?
Well, maybe I should write this, but I thought it was...
I don't quite know what you're asking. And
I was just wondering if anyone is taking that seriously and looking to see what signal to noise was for cosmological background.
Okay.
Yes.
So we did look at stochastic background of our modes a couple of years ago, and it's not actually comparable. Basically, the conclusion was that you can get a single source if everything goes well with LIGO 2, but to get a stochastic background, you have to go down to LIGO 3. And I think it actually works that way with neutron star binaries as well. There's a paper by David Blair and Li Ju, I think. So yeah, there is a stochastic background, but it's fainter. You do much better when you're picking up a single bright source. Great.
You set your narrow band on 600 hertz. Then you look for the R modes in the right when the frequency comes into the middle of this dip of the curve. Signal to noise ratio is about 10. So you know it's there. Then you move your mirror a little bit and you follow this narrow spin down so that it always stays in the middle of this dip. And then you can get probably fantastic signal to noise energy.
Oh, that would be great if you could follow it all the way down. The trouble is, you're gonna have a hell of a time talking the experimenters into doing that.
No, that's actually easy because all they have to do is to move.
Yeah, you ask Fred Rob about that, and he's gonna say, "Oh, all I have to do is open up my nice pristine vacuum cavity and move this junk."
No, but you have to move it by a fraction of the way. It can be done by
another problem from our point of view, we'd actually have to tell them the rate at which the traffic is, right? Which means we have to know not just the Fourier transform, but we have to know the rate at which the frequency is.
Right. And that rate goes as saturation amplitude squared, so we don't know it to within orders of magnitude.
Presumably, once you detect the signal, right, once you use your rate analysis techniques, you will know it, right? I mentioned that you can do a rate analysis concurrently, right? This is the only way that you can detect it.
Yeah, I agree.
So if you do rate analysis concurrently, you know, well, it's going down the sun with some frequency, you know the saturation, you just follow it.
So it looks like that could maybe make it.
No, it's
factor.
No, it's the
10, 20,
Now, that feels like it'd be...
That was a logarithmic plot.
No, that feels like it'd be really tough, because you're going to try and grab this thing when it gets to 600 hertz. So this is what? So this line is a factor of 10 above the noise line there. But what that's saying, remember, in order to pick this up, you're gonna have to integrate up on it, and it's going to be drifting through this band while you're doing that. And if we assume the slow cooling, which is modified ERCA, then it takes days. No. The total signal to noise you're picking up, you have to get while integrating up.
Even if it's thermal noise, right? You just take the thermal noise as your floor, and you can do it.
Yeah.
No, the point is you can seriously reduce the shot noise.
You could just take the thermal noise for it, because you know what the thermal noise floor is.
This thing is very misleading for the situation you're talking about. This is a curve that you get, which has a factor built into it, which includes the fact that you're integrating, sitting on a line for a while. So in order to catch something, the instantaneous amplitude signal noise, like if you're looking at a chart recorder, you're not going to see this big thing jump out a factor of 10 above the noise. No, you're going to have to sit on it while it's moving through a band. And I think the time scale is of order a day or so, even at this point. So you wouldn't know you'd gotten the thing until you'd gone back and analyzed a day's worth of data, which would take a day. And by then, it would have moved, and I don't know. You would have to guess. You would have to guess where it went. My guess is that that would be really nice if we could do it, but that would be really tricky to do in practice.
LIGO
pie in the sky.
So if you were talking about LIGO 3, where would the curves be?
LIGO 3.
This is fiction.
LIGO 3 might be more of a fiction. I think the probability of detecting our noise would be larger, if it exists.
Oh, with LIGO 3, you're gonna be throwing the damn things out as noise. It's LIGO 3 has.
Virgo, you might be talking about two events.
Well, that's Virgo's configuration that's supposedly comparable to this, not Virgo's final configuration.
Virgo cluster.
So the Virgo cluster, there's something like a supernova every week, I think.
Yeah, but how many of those are going to...
But how many of those, we don't know. We don't know, so maybe...
Right. So maybe it's...
Say it's one a year.
No, it's not. And so that's not so high. So the question is how much better are you going to... Or how much farther are you going to get LIGO 3?
If you've got LIGO 3, I think the bottom of this curve gets down to 10 to the minus 23 or so. It's in the gravitational waves paper. Those numbers haven't changed. They're still just as fictional as they were in 1998. It's like a factor of 3 or 4 or 5 for further or something like that. And the event rate goes up like the cube of that. Yeah, so it's 100 times more event rate. Yeah, LIGO 3, the damn things are probably going to be overlapping. Of course, that's why you get a stochastic background of them. Duty cycle better than...
Great.
Thanks, Ethan.